Our 1 o'clock meeting is convening at 5 o'clock tonight, June 22nd, 2007. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 623 and ask Mary to give us a bill summary. And then, Senator, if you'd come forward while she's doing that, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
While she's getting organized, let me simply say that we have an hour between now and the time that the we have to go back to the floor because the Ways and Means Committee is meeting and we will need a time for a quorum. So I'm going to try to expedite this hearing and then move on to the other bills that we have to get done as part of our end of session planning. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 623A exempts a dwelling and lot on which the dwelling is located that has a religious organization provided to its spiritual leader. The exemption amount shall currently under this bill shall not exceed $150,000 of the assessed value of the parsonage, and the parsonage does not qualify for the exemption if the spiritual leader of the religious organization occupies another residence as his or her primary residence. It does not provide the exemption if the occupant receives pay for use of the property unless the pay is for foster care provided in the dwelling, effective after January 1, 2008. We have a -383 amendment which would reduce that exemption amount to cap it at $50,000 per parsonage.
Thank you. Senator Monroe, thank you for attending today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for holding this hearing today. Let me tell you a little bit about the genesis of this bill. Mr. LaFont, Senator Brown introduced this bill at the request of Mr. LaFont. Mr. LaFont is in Indiana right now, or he'd be with me. Mr. LaFont has been a friend of mine all our lives. He's a man about my age. He was born in Africa. His parents were missionaries in Kenya. And so he comes from a family of people that have been active in the church all his life. He is the head deacon at a little community church, Richmond Community Church in southeast Portland. That is the church that I grew up in. The parsonage in question, my father helped build 60 years ago. Parsonages used to be very common. Churches regularly would have a parsonage, a home attached to or very near the church for their pastor or spiritual leader to live in. And that would be part of their remuneration, would be providing that person with a place to live. Today, most churches have abandoned that practice, and in fact, today, most ministers receive a housing allowance as a part of their compensation. That housing allowance is tax-free and often makes up a significant portion of their remuneration. There is some counties count parsonages as tax-exempt. Some do not. Multnomah County does not. There are very few parsonages left. The closest calculation we could come, and the department had trouble figuring it out, but we checked with 24 different counties, got some responses, and calculated that there might be as many as 492 parsonages left in Oregon across the state. This bill caps the parsonage at a value at $150,000, which is a very, as you know, very minimum house at this time. To lower it further to $50,000, I think almost just might as well kill the bill. It's of very little value. I would hope you would leave it at $150,000. This clarifies that parsonages are exempt, and so counties like Multnomah County would exempt them. The amount of revenue lost would be very, very minimal. If, in fact, the church that has a parsonage doesn't want to use it for their spiritual leader, their pastor to live in, and wants to rent it out, then it's taxable. If they use it for any other purpose that doesn't have to do directly with the church, then it's taxable. It's only tax-free under this measure if, in fact, the pastor lives there, and so on. Now, our committee talked, the Senate Revenue Committee talked a lot about this measure, talked about the fact that pastors don't work 9 to 5. Pastors are available on call at all times. So having the parsonage nearby the church makes a big difference. People can go and knock on his door at 2 a.m. And Grandpa just died. Can you come and help us? Or there's been a terrible car accident. My daughter's in the hospital. Can you come and pray with her? Pastors are in that kind of work where they're on call 24/7. Churches that want to have a parsonage or that have a parsonage and want their pastor to live in it ought to be encouraged to do this. I think it helps our spiritual leaders to better serve their flock. I've been a lay leader in my church all of my life. My church I attend does not have a parsonage, but in fact we go the other route and give our spiritual leader, our pastor, a significant housing allowance instead. I think this is levels the playing field, brings fairness to those churches that want to have a parsonage with those churches that don't. And this bill did pass the Senate unanimously after coming out of the Revenue Committee unanimously. I would hope that you would support it as it passed the Senate. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Monroe, for this excellent testimony. One thing that I am interested in is I've been involved in the work of the tax issues relative to ministry, and you're right, there is a very healthy allowance. That many times that allowance more than accommodates for the house. Housing. Could we save income tax in this process if we had more of the ministers, the ministry actually living in parsonages where there would not have to be such a healthy housing allowance, you think?
Oh, absolutely. Housing allowance not only includes the mortgage payment or rent, but also includes all utilities and all other costs of being in a house, and it's totally tax exempt. So if instead a church like Richmond Church Community Church had a parsonage and the pastor lived in it, he would then be not receive a housing allowance and would be paying taxes on his whole salary instead of just that part that was not a part of a housing allowance.
So just a brief follow-up, if I may. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Senator Monroe, there's approximately something less than 500 estimated parsonages presently in the state. If we had a full $150,000 allowance for parsonages, do you think, and it used to be that every church had a parsonage. I know in Ontario the parsonages are there, but they now are renting them out typically. And the newer churches are not built with parsonages. Do you think that this would probably create an opportunity for more parsonages to be built in conjunction with and adjacent to the facilities if we encourage this?
You know, that's a possibility. I think it would be more likely to happen in the more rural parts of the state probably than in urban areas where there's lots of housing available and so on. And that's a possibility. I think it would be more likely to preserve some of those parsonages that still exist and allow them to have economic viability in providing that kind of housing for their pastor.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Broome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator, for your testimony. Are you convinced that this bill has adequate sideboards or are sideboards somewhere in statute that would keep, you know, I don't know what it is, but a fly-by-night religion from, you know, using
hey,
this?
Hey, wait a minute.
What's that?
That's me. I was thinking of forming my own church with a parsonage.
Yes, absolutely. This would only deal with legitimate churches that are certified and their licensed pastor, licensed or accredited pastor. Also there are other sideboards in terms of specifying specifically what the building has to be used for to get this exemption. And then there's the lid on the exemption of $150,000. Very, very few houses are worth $150,000 or less. Most, even modest homes nowadays are at least $250,000, so it wouldn't totally exempt. The little house that's in question here that generated this bill is probably worth about $250,000.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you. That did spawn the question of what happens. Will this foster more folks to try and create these kinds of exemptions? And really the resolution to that is if they were inclined to create that kind of an exemption, they would do exactly what the good senator is probably has referred to, and that is they would probably move to that Church of the What's Happening Now and create an exemption for that minister and ordain themselves the minister and then create a huge tax-free exemption. And so the likelihood, if there was an abuse, the abuse would be in the opposite direction of what we're trying to go here, and that is to encourage them to move on to church property as opposed to encouraging them to take a tax-free housing allowance.
Since the exemption from federal and state income taxes would be much more significant than this modest allowance.
Thank you. The property that a pastor who has a housing allowance may rent or pay a mortgage on, is that subject to property tax?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Gail?
Chair, we pick our battle and we know our friends, so we're not going to be speaking.
They don't want to.
Mr. Phillips? Well, I do have some questions, and I'm concerned about the issue that Representative Butler raised. Let me just frame the question for you. In the context of another statute that I've studied recently, the marriage statute, one of the requirements for someone who is allowed to officiate at marriages is being a judge or a county clerk or a few other people, and the other category is religious ministers or practitioners. There doesn't appear to be a definition in the law of who such people are. I guess they're self-proclaimed or they're ordained by some group or another. And I'm wondering what sideboards, if any, we have around this, the definition of spiritual leader of the religious organization. What are there in tax law now that would cover this situation?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips, the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm not familiar with the marriage laws of Oregon other than
I raise that only as an illustration because it appears to be very easy for someone to qualify under that law.
Sure. I believe, and I don't have the specific requirements with me, but I believe that there's a 501c3 requirement that they be a nonprofit organization. Their bylaws have certain requirements as to their purpose, whether it be their religious purpose, and I can get that information for you, but I just didn't have it with me today. There is quite a bit of information on that about what qualifies and a lot of litigation that's gone on over the past 20 or 30 years that kind of cements that in. So that has not really been raised as an issue in terms of fly-by-night type organizations trying to qualify.
So if one were to form a 501c3 corporation and register as a religious organization, collect a congregation, and set up a facility in one room of the parsonage for the church, one would probably qualify for this exemption.
Mr. Chair, that may very well be true. I hesitate to venture a guess, though, without having more information with me. I apologize.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'd be happy to get that if you'd like.
Thank you. Are there others who would like to be heard today on Senate Bill 623? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just would say this. Probably a few years ago when you were practicing law, the 501c3 was a much more easily established organization than it is today. Back then we could establish 501c organizations under any of the exemptions fairly easily. Today the department or the Internal Revenue Service really polices that much more actively, has a longer period of time for the phase in and the authentication with the necessary number of filings. So Again, it's, I think it's probably a little more difficult. I did have a question for staff.
Please.
Relative to the two sets of 623A and the 623A2.
It's really for A3.
And the A3, I didn't have A2 is for A3. I'm sorry. Okay. And, Mr. Chair, I do have an A2 amendment, but I think that it's probably being taken care of in a different House Bill 3201.
I don't have the A2.
Oh, I don't have it either.
Well, it was just handed as a potential. And the person who handed it to me indicated that they probably didn't want to go ahead with it.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
So this thing that's labeled A2 is really A3.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And I just wanted to add, if I may, that some of the data that I looked at for the revenue impact on this, and I'll be glad to check some of your questions, because the department has a list of churches from the survey that it did that it felt would be qualified for the exemption with the parsonage. So the churches would be roughly 5,000 churches have parsonages, of which 7% already are currently exempt because they use it for foster care or whatever, so that falls into the exemption. So that suggests to me, if I look into their rules or the law, that they're, it's not going to be as easy as you might think to create, to go through all the trouble to create a 503-C3 entity, create a parsonage without a church, and create some activity in it that would warrant the exemption. But I'll be glad to check that for you.
Question of staff. Thank you. Any indication of the dollar amounts that are being paid as exempt compensation to ministers on behalf of the amounts which they use for housing at present?
Didn't have that. All I did get from the sample that was taken by the DOR survey was that the average value, assessed value, was about $128,000, contrary to what Senator Monroe had suggested, that you know, quite a few homes or parsonages are valued in excess of $250,000. But maybe in rural areas where a lot of these are still existing, it's not that they're not valued that much.
My experience in our area is that that $150,000 would be a lot for a parsonage residence.
Right.
Now, let me inquire too. As we're talking, I thought of a question I probably should have asked earlier. When a church builds a parsonage, the church does not have to pay income taxes on the funds that are used to build the parsonage, do they?
I don't believe so.
Okay, I mean that's just part of the exempt activity of a church, because the parsonage is used as involving church activities. Okay, so the equivalent of that for a church that doesn't have a parsonage is the housing allowance that they pay to the minister.
I would.
Okay.
But those funds are collected as charitable contributions to the congregation.
Well, of course, the funds that were used to build the parsonage presumably were collected that way,
right,
as well. I'm trying to build equivalencies here in my question. Okay, so on the other hand, if a minister lives in a house that he rents or that he pays a mortgage on, that's not church property, that he gets a housing allowance in order to pay for, then the minister or the landlord pays the property tax on that residence because it's being used as a residence. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So if the parsonage on church property, is the church allowed to deduct the cost of maintenance, utilities, and other costs for maintaining the parsonage?
It's on a Form 990, and it's other business activity. And I don't know whether John Phillips would be prepared to discuss that, but that would be unrelated activity to the charitable activities. And
well,
there is a limit that they can earn in unrelated business
activities. We're not talking about earnings. We're talking about paying the expenses of maintaining the parsonage and for utilities.
There's no... first of all, 990, of course, it's a tax-free, it's a tax-exempt organization.
Right.
What happens is the dollar amount that you're talking about is the dollar amount of the taxable income that you would be receiving by renting it out to a third party.
Well, let's suppose the minister lives there.
Oh, the minister living there?
Right. The minister lives in the parsonage. The church pays the maintenance, upkeep, the electric bill, the water bill, and those kind of things.
It's all related at that particular point. There's no expense nor income unrelated to the charitable activity.
Okay.
It's all related to the charitable activity.
And when currently, some parsonages in many counties, the church pays the property tax on the parsonage.
Yes, they do.
Currently.
Yes.
Just in the same way that the minister who receives a housing allowance would pay a property tax on a property that he has purchased himself.
That's right.
Okay.
And the church is paying that, of course, back to the counties out of exempt funds that it would be receiving from its congregation at that point.
Well, the point I'm getting at is, if I understand this correctly, that the situations are completely equivalent, whether you get a housing allowance and you have your own house and you pay property taxes on it, or if the church pays for the cost of a parsonage, maintains it, pays the utilities, and the minister lives there, and the church pays the property tax on the parsonage. Aren't those equivalent situations?
Except that, Mr. Chair, if I may, the minister who is receiving, and let's say that the living allowance happens to be $2,000 a month, if the non-taxable $2,000 a month is paid to the minister for the housing allowance, and the minister happens to purchase a residence and pay interest and pay property tax, the minister would then have a deductible sum against a tax-free allowance.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens then is that deductible sum against the tax-free allowance usually goes that the minister has to have other outside work, and almost always the wife is working on the outside in order to take care of the necessary bills, because we pay them so small,
right,
small amounts.
So the if there's a lack of equivalency, it's in the income tax, not the property.
And that's why I ask about the income tax implications here, because I think that you might have some savings in the amounts that are going out presently that are used then to deduct against other wages of the minister working part time somewhere else, or the minister's spouse.
Thank you. Is there anything else on the public hearing on Senate Bill 623?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler,
do you intend to have a work session on that today?
Not today. No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 623, and let's move to the. Are we ready to work? 550. Is 550 ready to work? Okay. Steve, are you on that one? Yeah. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 550. Colleagues, this is one of the bills that has been designated as part of the go-home package. Steve.
Mr. Chair and members, Bill 550-B deals with extending the sunset from 2007 to 2013 for the distributions of revenue from the revised Secure Rural Schools of Community Self-Determination Act. It would ensure that these federal funds that go to the counties and 25% of the federal forest fees or federal forest-related revenues deposited into the county school fund and distributed to school districts, and thereby would become part of local revenue included in the school equalization formula. The bill retroactively takes effect July 1, 2007, if passage is after that date. So what the bill is doing is continuing current policy that has been in practice for the last 5 years or 6 years while those revenues have been received from the federal government.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I know that there was a tremendous amount of pushback on this in prior sessions, that the Secure Rural School funds were in fact for the rural schools and not to be distributed into the state formula. And I don't know how strongly our constituents feel about that today. I would guess that if you were to ask whether they ought to be local funds maintained locally as opposed to going into the state fund to basically be passed to all schools in the state, there's still some small rural timber affected counties that would have, and some larger counties, larger school districts for that matter, including in Lane County, that would probably have pretty strong feelings that those funds ought to go and stay locally as opposed to going to the state school fund.
Thank you. And we also have a DAP 6 amendment.
Mr. Chair, yes. The Sixth Amendment does two things. One, it makes the minimum amount of state and local revenue for ESBs $1 million. So if the formula did not provide that amount, the amount is raised to $1 million, and then that has to come from the other ESDs. There's five ESDs that fall into that category. And I can provide you a table with the funding amounts if you like. The other part of the Dash 6 amendments is a study to be done by the Interim Revenue Committees concerning the adequacy of funding for small school districts and small education districts. And there is no funding connected with that study.
Okay. Dunlan?
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Steve has given you, I think, a really good rundown on the Senate Bill 550 being engrossed. This was discovered during a run-through on the distribution of those Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act funds. We found that the current statute, as it exists, was sunsetting on July 1st of 2007, which meant the money might not get to anybody, would end up in DAS and stay there. This merely extends for the next 5 years the existing program, and we'd certainly ask you to support the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alan Tressiter, representing the Oregon Small Schools Association. We bring you the Dash 6 amendments, and can tell you that that those amendments are very strongly supported by not only the Small Schools Association, but all other educational associations represented in this building. It is an important, particularly the study part for my group, is a very important issue, that we have small and rural schools in this state for whom the current school distribution formula does not work very well, that simply increasing the per-child distribution to those districts doesn't help the educational opportunities of those children, and we want to look at ways to increase educational opportunities for all children in Oregon. And let me tell you what this bill is not about. I've been asked to put on the record. This bill is not about school consolidation. This bill is not about taking from high-spending districts and giving to low-spending districts. This bill is very simply about taking a very hard look at how we distribute monies to small districts. And we have no preconceived illusions of what that outcome might be. But my association is willing to devote a lot of time and energy helping your revenue committee provide data and staff and anything else that is necessary to reach a conclusion or series of conclusions that might help the opportunities of children that go to school in very small school districts in this state. Ozzie, I think, wants to talk about the ESD portion of the amendment.
When we changed the formula and got an equalization formula back in the mid-90s or early 90s, we didn't address ESDs, and some four or five sessions ago, we addressed equity amongst the distribution of ESDs. And the way we set up the formula, we set a floor of $1 million for the five small ESDs that wouldn't generate that much money just on a per-student distribution. And the way we implemented it, we take the pot of money that's for ESDs, and then we say how that would be distributed, and then we look at the counties or the ESDs that have less than $1 million, and then we assess all ESDs, including those five, whatever ratio it takes to pay that off. And result of that is that the floor has never been reached. I think it got to about a high. Well, excuse me. We have subsequently lowered that $1 million to $950,000. Also, next year the amount these people would get would be $932,000. If we pass this, they'll get $1 million at $68,000 per each. $330,000 total. It's not an additional appropriation. It's a redistribution of the total ESD pot. It's supported by all ESDs. And it's consistent with the original intent of having a floor. I have to confess that staff has informed me that I was part of the group that drafted the implementation thing, and all I can say is I must not have been paying attention to this issue at that time. But we would encourage you to do this. It's very important to Lake, Harney, Wallowa, Grant, and the North Central ESD. And for those of you who don't think $68,000 is an amount, the superintendent from Lake said that gets me a speech pathologist for this county. And we'd encourage you to support it. And we're also supportive of the study concept.
Thank you. Representative Kelster?
Mr. Chair, I think this is a great amendment. And as our school districts continue to try to meet a whole lot of diverse needs, I think especially in our rural areas, our smaller ESDs and our smaller districts who rely upon each other really could use this boost. I think it's a smart thing to do, and I really appreciate the study portion of the amendment.
The study portion?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Did you have a comment on the other portion?
Yes, I think it makes sense, and I do think that that amount of money will make a significant difference, not just to these ESDs, but to the students that they serve and the component districts that they're supporting.
Great. Thank you. Representative Olson, did you have a comment? Oh, okay. Thank you. Has this amendment been discussed with the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue?
This particular amendment that is before you, we've discussed with the Senate Minority Leader and Senate Majority Leader, and we got the indications that concurrence would not be a problem. I did not ship this particular amendment to the Senate Revenue Committee. I believe they're closed or near closure.
Well, actually, they're meeting right now.
I know, but I mean, after today.
Did they also have this amendment?
They had a portion of this amendment, yes.
Which portion did they have?
They had this amendment and an additional part of the amendment, which sunsetted the $5 million that small schools get. That bill went to the floor with those amendments in it. It was returned to committee. And I believe the understanding it was, and I don't want to quote anybody here, but I believe the understanding when it was sent back to committee was to take out the sunset on the small school grant money. Instead, the committee took everything out and just brought you the Senate Bill 550B that you have in front of you. I'm not clear why that happened, but I have support from the Senate leadership to put two components back in.
Okay, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there any discussion with the Senate Minority Leader relative to the actual distribution of funds for the secure rural schools? I know that gave him a great deal of angst previously. Any problem there? We're not going to have any difficulty.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm still a little bit puzzled about this amendment. The portion of it that has to do with the study, of course, the committee can do on its own. It doesn't need a statute to do that. The part about the $1 million minimum, if I'm reading this correctly, and maybe I'm not, but it looks as though there's a $950,000 amount in the current statute. Have I misread that in some way?
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the floor was $1 million when we drafted the change. When you had tough times here a couple sessions ago, we took money away from ESDs, lowered their share from 5% to 4.25%, and at that time we set, pardon me?
Four and three quarters,
I'm sorry. yeah. And at that time we lowered the floor to $950,000. But the floor, I'll remind you that all the money goes to ESDs, 90% of it goes to the districts and programs, and they only have 10% left for operations. And the floor is important in the sense of if the ESD isn't functional, there's no really need to have it. And that's why we are suggesting you go back to the $1 million floor to help them be viable partners with and servants of their component districts.
And Mr. Chair, I have heard from my ESDs because the 950,000, even when they were at the original $1 million, everybody was receiving the
less.
Smallest were receiving less than $1 million, and then when they went to the 950, then they're still sharing the overhead and they're receiving less still. So this just gives an opportunity for them to have base funding. Which floor funding or base funding is really an equitable amount at the $1 million based upon the operation costs to keep a speech therapist in Harney County or Grant County.
Thanks. If I may, Mr. Chair, could I comment on the study also?
I'm sorry?
May I comment on
yes,
the study?
Please.
Alan's been talking about that. That we implemented the formula on a per-student basis when we got Measure 5 and we needed equity. And we've had it that way for 15 years. Every session there have been suggestions how to change the formula. The one over there that will do away with the small school thing. There's always somebody that has an idea about fixing the formula. And I was involved in those for a long time, as you know. And all the ideas always benefit the proposer and are detrimental to somebody else. It's a zero-sum game. But I think the small school situation is different right now. Our schools are shrinking. Our populations are moving to population centers. Two-thirds of our districts are smaller every year. And there comes a point, I don't think it's as important with our elementary schools as it is with our high schools. If you get a really good teacher in an elementary classroom, I think that can be dealt with. But the breadth of opportunity for programs in our small high schools, with a high school with 45 kids in it. Now, there are some advantages to being in a small high school, but the kinds of courses and the kinds of material we want to expose our youngsters to so they can pass a variety of tests that we construct and so they can move out of different communities, move into communities, and fit everywhere. I think that we're not serving all of our kids in Oregon well. And the idea of the study is to focus on program access, not focus on the formula. Now, when it's all done, you're going to have to do something about how you provide that program. I don't know what it will be, but I think that it's worth doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Steve, would you explain the chart that you just distributed for us?
Mr. Chair, members, you have an ESD finance distribution. It's not labeled for the right amendment, but it addresses the same issue. What I have done is compared 0708 estimates under current law and to the proposal in Senate Bill 550-6B6, trying to indicate the amount of formula revenue that the ESD would get under current law. If you go down towards the bottom of the page, some of the smaller ESDs, Harney, North Central Grant, you'll see that it's $946,000, so a little bit less than the $950,000 when you do the final balance. And the amounts per student, you can see that for the smaller ESDs, it's typically over $500, where normally it's around $300. Then if you go over to the Senate Bill 550 proposal, the only change there is to make the small ESDs minimum amount $1 million. So you'll see five $1 million amounts in the formula revenue column under Senate Bill 550. The result is that for those small ESDs, each one would have about $53,000 or $54,000 more, and that would be around $30 to $40 per weighted student. The impact is spread over the other 15 ESDs, and that's about 40, 41 cents per weighted student for those ESDs as a reduction to compensate for the increase to the five small ESDs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I would like to move the B6 amendments to Senate Bill 550. B6 is dated 6/22/07.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the B6 amendment. Is there further discussion? I wonder if there's anyone here from the department who would like to be heard on this. I don't see anybody. What's your pleasure? Is there any objection to this amendment? No objection. The chair's not satisfied that we actually should be adopting this amendment, but I think I'm outvoted, so the amendment is adopted. Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 550 as amended today in House Revenue to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 550 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? I don't see any. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Burns.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Excuse.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Who would like to carry?
I will carry this one.
Representative Gelser will carry. And with that, thank you very much. With that, the motion's carried, and the bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on Senate Bill 550. Have we received the amendment on 816?
I believe so.
Thank you. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 816. What's it called?
Got it.
This is
the dash three.
Yes.
I don't have.
We have copies of dash three. This is the floating.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Can I just give? I'm not familiar with the amendment folder. Why don't I
talk about it, colleagues? While this amendment's being distributed, I hope it does what we're thinking that it does. We discovered today in House Bill 3201, which is back for concurrence from the Senate, that one of the sunsets that was indicated in the bill explanation was accidentally omitted. Rather than trying to reopen that bill, which has, as you know, a number of complex provisions, we thought it was prudent to take Senate Bill 816, which we had sitting in the committee, unused, as it were, and utilize resources available to us to fix that by dealing with that issue. Please distribute the amendments. Well, it's used that issue to fix that issue in a separate bill. So that's the point of this amendment, and I haven't had a chance to look at it either, so let's look at it together.
I can say this much about it. That it does. The original Bill 816 was not necessary from previous testimony that you've heard on this particular bill. Proponents basically said they didn't need it.
Right. 816 was actually inserted into a different bill, which was passed.
Okay.
And it's no longer needed for the original purpose. That's right.
So this amendment, as I read it, it looks like it's gut and stuffing. It's completely eliminating what's in 816 now, and it's replacing it with a section that will provide for a federal taxable income subtraction for an amount established for college savings established under a specific type of account that's specified under statute, and the subtraction from the income tax or from taxable income for taxing purposes would be equal to the lesser of $2,000 or $4,000, depending on whether it's a single taxpayer or a joint filing return. $4,000 for the joint filing and $2,000 for any other type of return.
Thank
and
you.
Then there's more to it, but I haven't got beyond that.
College, I would refer you to the Section 1, beginning of Section 1, which says that if House Bill 3201 becomes law, then this section of the statute is amended. And if you'll recall, we deal with many sunsets which, in effect, restate the statute in a different form rather than simply stating that the statute disappears, because the object here would not be to eliminate the college savings plan, but simply to return it to the status that it was in before 3201 was passed. That allows our successors to determine whether to review the College Savings Plan and determine what plans ought to be made, similar to the way in which we've handled other tax credit sunsets. That was the point of this. And this particular section was intended to have been inserted in House Bill 3201 and was omitted by error. Have I summarized that properly, Paul?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It's in 3201, it bumps those deductions from 1,000 single, 2,000 joint to double, 2,000 and 4,000.
And that's the italics, the material on the second
right.
page.
So what this amendment would do is return the program to current law in the year 2012 if it's not extended by through legislative action.
So in 2012 or 2013, the tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2012,
right.
That would begin in 2013 then?
For tax years beginning on or after 2000.
Right. The amendment, which is to adopt this change, mm-hmm. would begin on
the amendment.
Would begin on January 1, 2012. So it applies to 2012 tax years and subsequent. Would not apply to 2011.
The 2013 filing, I guess, is what it would be.
Right. Right. And if you'll recall, and I didn't bring it with me, but if you recall the grid that describes all the contents of House Bill 3201 says that this the 529 expansion is sunsetted on this date. But it isn't, because it's not contained in the bill. That's the point of this amendment.
So it would reduce. It has the effect of reducing the amount of college savings deduction available for families back to the amount that they are immediately prior to the passage of 3201.
Correct.
That's correct. Back to its current law level.
Oh, we have a call of the House. Colleagues. Can we act on this quickly, or do we need to recess?
Chair,
Representative
I would move the dash 3 amendments. This is an bill 816.
Representative Gelser moves the dash 3. Is there an objection?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I would like to look at my file on 3201, and I did not bring that today, not knowing what the gist and tenor of this amendment was.
Well, let's recess the committee then on the call of the House.
I withdraw my motion.
Thank you. The motion is withdrawn. In fact, we could recess in whether the motion was there or not. But in any event, thank you for that. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 816, and we will be in recess pending call of the chair. Thank you.
Is there files here, Mr. Chair?
I don't know whether there's another committee planning to use this room tonight.
I think so.
Don't think so.
I think it's safe to do that.
I do plan to get back here later on. Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, we've had a robust conversation on 816, and I'm going to move the dash 3 amendments to 816 dated 622.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves the dash 3 amendments. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the dash 3s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move 816 as amended today in committee to the floor of the House of Representatives with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves Senate Bill 816 as amended to the floor. With a due pass recommendation, is there discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Brenner.
Aye.
Representative
Lynch.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Yes. Aye.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. The motion having received the required majority, Senate Bill 816 as amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who'd like to carry? Representative Butler will carry. He'll have fun explaining why we need this bill. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. The last item on our agenda today, we've done the others, haven't we? 550
yes,
we
yes,
finished.
Yes.
And 816 we finished. The one we haven't done is House Bill 2779. So we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 2779. Right on cue. Yeah. We just passed 816. as amended.
Okay.
So, all right. Colleagues, you recall that we worked on this one a while yesterday, I believe.
And the issue was leased employees.
Leased employees, and we have a new amendment, I think. Is that right, Mr. Esselman?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Jack Esselman, Tonkin Torp, representing the Software Association of Oregon. We have the dash 8-5s, which we would encourage you to move this evening. What do those amendments do in principle is delete the phrase starting at the beginning. They delete the phrase in annual full-time employment and insert in the definitional section both annual full-time equivalent employment and in the definitional section for annual gross payroll the phrase in a year. Those are just clarifying changes. This bill, this concept has been reworked on several occasions from its introduction at the policy committee, and there was some language in there that was extraneous and had the potential to be conflicting with other provisions of the bill. So Elsie took a final scrub of it last night. I reviewed the bill, and I, at least to my eye, it appears to be in good order. The remainder of the amendment, I should hasten to add, fills in the blanks that were created at the policy committee in terms of dollar amounts, number of certifications, and a percentage on transferability of the tax credit. And then in the middle, there's another clarifying change around the department's certification of a facility for the tax credit. It's really just a change in the tense so that they can they will be obviously certifying before the facility is created. And the language in the A and Gross version suggested that the facility would have to be complete before they do the certification. That didn't work under the concept of the bill. So the language on lines 9 through 16 of the A5 amendments helps to clarify that.
Question
from Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jack, are we using tax increment financing for tax credit increment financing for other economic development purposes in the state? Where do we use this?
Yeah, Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, we use it depends how you define tax increment finance, but you know, arguably all of our economic development incentives are an element or have an element of tax increment financing. Certainly,
I guess this is wage increment financing.
Right, this is wage increment financing. The tax that's normally used for tax increment financing is the property tax in most of our incentives.
So where are we using it, if I may, Mr. Chair?
We are using it in the strategic investment program, with which you may be familiar, and we are using it in the enterprise zone program. Again, those are both property forms of property tax relief and abatement.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. My question is, where are we using wage increment financing in the form of wage credits?
In the bill.
I mean, but other than, where have we used it in the past?
Oh, we haven't.
It's never been used.
That's, to my knowledge, that's correct.
So, follow up then.
Please.
We have experimented. We've looked around the country and we've seen this used in some, actually, I think we cast it out and tried to fish around 4 years ago now, and nobody was doing it. Since we started to ask, and actually I think it was someone who went to the East Coast that really had a pretty good wage increment financing program set up, and she went back to the East Coast, and now many of the eastern states are using this. What's the success ratio?
Right. Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, I think I've distributed on prior occasions, and I have more copies here if you want to take a look at it, a document that actually was prepared by the Economic Development Department around these types of wage increment or payroll-based incentives. There's 19 states that have similar programs. Interestingly, to your point, Representative Butler, many of these were enacted in the early part of this decade or in the late part of the last decade, which we believe is reflective of an economic trend that tax increment financing for economic development, relying solely on the property tax, is becoming at least increasingly less effective to attract certain types of employers who don't have the real property need, but have great job creation potential. The document I have doesn't talk about results, although I can say, at least anecdotally, each of these were put on the books and remain on the books in the 19 states where they are, so at least by way of inference, we can assume they're reasonably successful enough that they haven't been repealed, and nor have they been, again by inference, abused by virtue of the fact that they remain on the books in these 19 states.
Mr. Chair, I thank you very much, Jack, for that. And I've been calling it wage increment financing. It's really payroll-based incentives, I guess, is the correct term. And I didn't know what it was called. Thank you, Jack. I do have that.
Mr. Chair. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question, Jack. With the amendment, we're inserting language around licensed worker leasing company. I just want to clarify, it would be my understanding that the intent then would be that the calculation would be based on what the employee receives, not what the worker leasing company receives. Is that correct?
Right. The credit derives from the definition of annual gross payrolls, and as defined, that's wages, salaries, and other remuneration paid in a year to the employee. So the credit, you would not be able to obtain a credit for any amount you paid a third party employee leasing company, for example, to get the employee. And in fact, we're just putting in statute what the Economic Development Department already uses in their rules when they apply the property tax increment incentives. The focus is on full-time job creation. It's not so much about how that employee arrives at the site. Now, these are not temporary workers. I want to stress that. This is a situation where basically the administration of the employee function is off with a contractor, but otherwise the employee works and is on the payroll of the employer.
Thank you.
Withholdings done by the employer, et cetera.
Thanks. Okay, so if I could, just to follow up on that, the term gross payroll means wages, salaries, and other remunerations paid to persons employed, modifies not only by a business firm, but also by a licensed worker leasing company.
That's just, in effect, what the sentence is supposed to be.
Right. Contracting with a business firm.
Right.
That's otherwise eligible for.
Right.
The program.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have, and I'm sorry, Jack, I'm sure you know the answer, do we have sufficient performance measurements built into the program? I assume that OECD already does that, and this bill came back through that committee. So they are they do they monitor, and then sometime before 2013, somebody will come back reporting that these are working and actually enhancing the number of employees in the industry that it's intended for.
Representative Barnhart and Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, I almost got that almost back in last session for a second. First I'll say that there are reports coming out of this session that the Economic Development Department will need to do both under Senate Bill 350, and I think there's another bill that they're going to have to do reports on their host of incentives. This incentive, if added to their portfolio, would be covered by that. I'd also add, this is really intended as a pilot program, and with a great amount of effort expended by Representative Brad Witt in his policy committee, we really worked the bill in, I think, two or three work sessions to make sure that it would be going to incent the types of jobs we want to create. And companies that employ 500 or fewer workers, companies that are adding high-wage jobs, 150% of median county wage, net job adders, not job shifters. So you got to add five new jobs in state. You got to keep five new jobs in state. If you don't keep five new jobs, we're going to come back and take our credit back. So I think the committee was very industrious in its work in making us put sufficient sideboards around the program so we can pilot it adequately. We think it'll we heard testimony from the Economic Development Department at the Policy Committee that they believe the program could have some very beneficial utility for them. We obviously as an association believe our members will benefit from it. And we also think it's been appropriately structured so that it's not an open giveaway or a blank check by any stretch.
Thank you. Representative Reed?
Are we ready for a motion, Mr. Chair?
Please.
I move the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 2779.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves the A5. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? The A5s are adopted. Representative Reed?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2779 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves House Bill 2779 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? I don't see any. Please call the roll.
Representative Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. The motion having received the required majority, House Bill 2779 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Reed, should we put this on the consent calendar or would you prefer to carry it?
I would defer that question to the representative to my left.
That was intended to be a joke. Indeed. Would you like to carry the bill?
I'd be happy to. I would also offer the chance to my co-sponsor.
Oh, yes, Representative Brune. Thank you. Both of you are on this committee, please. Representative Reed, Representative Brune will carry. And with that, we close the work session on House Bill 2779. Colleagues, we have one more bill on the due pass list, which is still in the Senate. We expect it to be passed out of the Senate tomorrow. They don't meet, I believe, until the afternoon. They meet at 1 o'clock. So be prepared when the bill gets to the House. It will be assigned to the committee and be prepared for a meeting to consider that bill. And the topic is...
Blinky things, Mr. Chair?
No, the in the process of constructing House Bill 3201, the Senate version that you're considering concurrence with, there's a number of credits that were put into that bill, and several of the bills that had credits in them also had substantive policy changes related to it. This bill, Senate Bill 635, the credit has been pulled out and made part of 3201, but the substantive part remains in Senate Bill 635. It's for the film and video credit that the governor has requested, and the film and video office folks will be here to describe it. It's a program change for them. It would have no revenue impact.
In the bill itself.
Bill itself. Had
right. No revenue impact. Be prepared, colleagues, to meet sometime in the afternoon on that bill. When we get it, if we're to meet our schedule, we have to act on it tomorrow.
Yes.
Correct?
Correct.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much. The committee stands adjourned.